Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akil, and in this episode we cover how to be a great product manager. Joining me today is Roman Archa from Google, and he shares what makes a great product manager as well as how to help and coach people to be their best version of themselves. Enjoy! Beyond coding. I was wondering, since you said you love surfing, I'm going to go work remote in March from Sri Lanka. One of the things I want to do is surf.
Right.
Basically, how'd you get into surfing?
Oh, that's very interesting. I actually tried it out in 2017 while I was on a holiday in probably one of the least surfing destinations, which was in Greece.
Oh, okay.
And the thing with Mediterranean is it just doesn't have those good waves for surfing. It's a little slow. And I was on the beach and I've seen this guy training some kids. Mm. So I thought, that's interesting. You know, I was bored. So I just went there, tried it out. Of course, when you do it first time, you're totally stoked because every possible chemical runs through your body and gives you the drive.
Yeah.
But of course, you don't really get much out of it. And somehow with this, I paused for a year, and then, you know, a year later, 2 years later, I was in Portugal.
Mm.
And
where in Portugal?
So with a friend of mine, we went to one of the surf camps.
Okay.
And this friend of mine has been living then in San Diego.
Okay.
So lots of surf, doing tons of surfing, and we decided to go on a surf trip.
Mm.
Which was a completely different experience, because even in summer, south of Lisbon, you'd get waves that are at least 2-3 meters tall if there is a proper swell.
It's a different ball game.
Well, I shouldn't say I didn't catch a single wave, right? And I got pounded the whole week.
Yeah.
But that pleasure of waking up in the morning, putting that wetsuit, carrying that board on a very steep hill, spending the whole day in the water, and especially that I am absolutely in love with the beach. Mm. I can spend the whole day on the beach if you allow me. In good company, in people with people that generally come there to have fun.
Yeah.
It was just enticing. And I really started to enjoy it. And when I moved to the Netherlands, which was probably about 5 years ago, I very deliberately chose a place to live near the beach. Around Haarlem.
Nice.
And that sort of pushed me to get myself my own equipment, my surfboards, you know, the wetsuits. Of course, it's not the Portuguese or Northern Spain surfing experience here, but it's not about that. Mm. It's about going consistently there, grabbing your board. And I do it the whole year round. You know, I would do it in January when the water temperature is like 6 degrees and outside is like 5 and chill wind. And that moment when you just take that board, you go into the water, and often it's just you here because the surf community is there. It's just not very active. And, you know, the place is not that well meant for surfing here.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm indeed the only or maybe just one of 3, 4, 10 people in the water. And you sit in there, you wait for the waves to come, and it's a very meditational type of experience.
Yeah, sounds calming.
Exactly, exactly. And I also learned that while, you know, even if you're dressed up, eventually it's rather freezing here.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that moment when you get out of the water, the moment when you change, the moment when you get this hot shower, it's almost like a cleansing moment for yourself and your body and your mind. And that's why, you know, I continue doing this. Mm. People think it's a little bit of an extreme experience to do it here in the Netherlands, especially in winter.
Yeah.
I think that everyone has their own moments of pleasure in life. That's mine.
Nice. I like that a lot. I work remote sometimes, and I've done it 2 years ago in Barcelona, and last year I went to Portugal for the month in Lagos.
Mm-hmm.
And then my girlfriend bought me this surfing lesson together with her for my birthday.
Nice.
And I had done it before, but then I'm talking about more than 10 years ago, like in high school with the class then. So this was the first time where we had to wake up super early. There was this random bus which just picked us up, picked up a group of people. And then we went down this cliff, exactly as you said. It was a beautiful, beautiful beach. And that was not the first beach we went to. We actually drove to multiple beaches and the guy kept saying, no, these waves are not good. Then we finally went in and I had underestimated how physically exhausting I would be at the end of it. Like I normally don't have breakfast. I have lunch like at 12-ish, kind of do intermittent fasting, but it's on and off. So I hadn't eaten anything. Yeah. I had a ball of water, but again, that's like just water. It's not going to give you that much energy basically. And at the end of it, also the teacher made us go in and out and then go on land and, for example, keep paddling on the sand until we really got it down. And we would have to jump up multiple times on the sand, not even on the water. So then when I actually got into the water, at the end of it, I was just destroyed. And I would look over to my partner, and she's also a bit smaller in size. One wave would just destroy her, and I'd be like, well, she's washed away. But then finally, again, what you said, when I took kind of that hot shower and then reflected on that period, that was so much fun. I really, really enjoyed it. And I don't get the opportunity often. So I'm really looking forward to doing that again in Sri Lanka. I think it's going to be a blast.
That is amazing. And you know what's interesting with surfing? Well, first of all, it's absolutely interesting that you discover parts of your body and muscles in your body you never even knew existed. Mm-hmm. Just because they start to ache.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, I've spoken about this several times, how I think that starting to practice surfing made me a better product manager.
Mm.
And you'd be like, oh, how is that even related? And I always say that it's very interesting with surfing, because in surfing, you get into this water. And of course, you could paddle at every single little bump in the water.
Yeah.
But you'll get exhausted and there will be no result out of it. So in surfing, timing is very important. And waiting for the right wave, right? Mm. As you could think about waiting for the right trend, is what sets you up for an eventual nice ride.
Yeah.
Timing your paddle, making sure that you're second and second synchronized with the wave, is what sets you up for the right moment. So actually, if you look at surfing experience and what does it take to be a good surfer, which is understanding of the trend on the horizon when the swell starts to come, understanding when to start paddling, understanding how to get into the wave. Do you need to go right? Do you need to go left? The stamina that you have to develop to make it happen, it's not very different from, you know, doing complex day-to-day mental work.
Yeah.
It's just that this is very much reflected in the mix of mental and physical work while you're in the water.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's really funny because I don't know if I mentioned it when we spoke like a few weeks back, but I have a new role now.
Mm.
I'm going to be product manager for about 3 to 6 months. And I've never done that. I've done that, let's say, not having the title, more so within a team, some of the responsibilities. But for this assignment in the coming future, I'm going to have full responsibility over that part of the role, let's say.
That's exciting.
And one of the things I really wanted to talk about with you is, okay, what makes a really good product owner, at least in your experience? I love that you say patience is one of it, waiting for and kind of reading the flow and then seeing when the opportunity is there, just like surfing, exactly the same. I recognize that. But what else do you think makes for a really good product owner? Because I really want to learn from you there.
Right. Well, it's a question that I get asked often.
Yeah.
And I probably have a non-standard answer to it.
Okay.
In my sort of experience so far, and you know, when it comes to technology, I've been leading, or I've been myself in any type of IT role you could imagine.
Mm.
System administration, project management, engineering management, product management. The thing with product managers, what I learned by being one, but also by having a team to grow, is that it's a very particular profession.
Okay.
And most things in product management could be learned.
Mm.
But there are some things that are characteristics that are slightly harder to learn.
Okay.
And if you ask me what a good product manager or what would set up someone for success in the product management role, I've identified for myself a subset of things that are slightly harder to learn. Mm. First, in my opinion, you really, really should be comfortable in ambiguity.
Okay.
And the more senior you are, the more ambiguity you have or you have to deal with. Imagine for a second that now you, Patrick, are the product manager in here, and someone comes to you and says, we actually decided to build a rocket.
Okay.
And sometimes that's the only input you'll get.
Yeah.
People who really succeed in the product management profession are not afraid of that statement. Mm. They're like, oh, that's curious. A rocket.
Yeah.
So that curiosity and comfort of being in a hyper-ambiguous situation at all times, yourself, with customers, understanding what are you solving for, is something that some people have and some people don't. Mm. And people that don't have it, they go into that backing off reaction. That sort of, I'm stuck.
Yeah.
What do you mean, a rocket? We're not a rocket company. And those that have it, they'll find this exciting and they'll start to look around. The other aspect is, in product management, especially, it's very important to learn to think through alternatives.
Okay.
Many people think in very binary terms. Mm. So you have to achieve a goal. It either is going to work or not going to work. As a product manager, you understand that there is an entire spectrum of opportunities and choices that you can make. And everything is a balance of risk, reward, and other parameters. The more experienced you are as a product manager, the more of those parameters in that balance you can identify, and the better alternatives you can choose. Mm. Thinking through alternatives, again, puts you in a situation where whatever you're facing with an unknown, which is what you will have to deal with a lot as a product manager, you're still able to find a path forward and move the team forward. And then the third thing that I think that is really, really crucial is being able to influence people. Mm. And I just cannot stress how important is that for a product manager, because in any organization that I've seen, product management is a side org, which does not really have formal reporting or formal influence over the organization. You have to work with engineering, you have to work with documentation, you have to work with UX, you have to work with UI, marketing, writers. Sometimes there are tens, hundreds of different functions that need to be involved to create a complete product experience.
Yeah.
Now people understand what your role is, but that doesn't mean that they would all go towards the goal that you aspire for. Mm-hmm. The capability for you to understand everyone's needs, everyone's capabilities, plug them properly into the chain of events, and inspire them to go towards the destination that you're looking to get to, is what defines really good product managers. All the rest of the stuff, I believe, is broadly teachable. Mm. Of course, you should have some sense of the domain and things like this, but as long as you are comfortable in ambiguity, as long as you can think for alternatives, as long as you can influence people, and then you're curious enough to invest in all the aspects that make a product complete, you should be on a good path to product management.
I think that's awesome. What interested me in the role in the first place is I like to understand the why. And also, just by virtue of having multiple conversations on this podcast, I've learned that curiosity is a big driver of me and it can bring me quite far. So I feel like I am very curious innately as a person. That's what I have. And I understand that you say that not everyone has that, and that's a hard thing to teach, because either you're interested and curious, or you just, maybe you couldn't care less, basically, because I've also heard that. The second part, when you said, okay, thinking alternatives, that for me is always tricky because once I have an idea, I can be anchored and biased towards that. And I like to think in alternatives, but still I have a preference in that way. What I tend to do is I tend to bring in outside perspectives and I try and be objective and not let my ideas, let's say, hold me back for better alternatives. Is that also what you do when you say you think in alternatives? Do you gather, let's say, the team or the business in that way and do like a brainstorm and facilitate that? Or when the alternatives, when you said think in alternatives, does that usually come and stem from yourself?
Generally speaking, you should always search for other perspectives. Either you agree with them or not.
Yeah.
It's also part of product management. It is quite probable for all of us, and it's in our nature, to be anchored and biased towards what we believe is the right outcome of a certain journey we're taking.
Mm.
As a product manager, generally, you should have some level of conviction.
Yeah.
Because if you're not convinced that what you're pushing for is the right direction, it's going to be very hard to convince also other people.
Mm.
You shouldn't get ever in the trap of falling into that conviction so deeply where you cannot accept other perspectives and course correct.
Yeah, that's the hard part.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And this is a muscle that you should develop. Like, inherently, and it is within human nature for us to feel the voids in ideas, thinking, or speech.
Mm.
You're a very smart person. Whatever I talk to you, I am sure that even after doing months or years of podcasting, whatever I'm putting an idea on the table, but you think that I'm going too slow or maybe not going in the right direction, you in your brain are trying to fill those voids with, okay, where is this person going? Let me tell what's the right thing to do.
Mm.
This is a big trap, especially in product management,
okay,
right? You have to develop that capability to listen to the essence and not to the fluff surrounding that essence in the conversation.
Yeah.
Understanding why someone says what they say. What is the approach these people are coming from? Is exactly that aspect of empathy that is very important for product management. And I believe that empathy actually is something that you can learn.
Mm.
Easier than other things. With empathy, it's very important to get yourself into a routine of trying to put yourself in the shoes of others.
Yeah.
Once you are not coming to the conversation from the perspective, I'm a guest and Patrick is a host, so we will always be in that situation, but you could turn the tables around and try to understand, what does Patrick want from this conversation?
Hmm.
Then suddenly you start thinking differently. You know, when we started, when we had this conversation, we were scheduling the whole podcast, I asked you to give me two free links to other podcasts,
yeah,
that you thought are some of the best that you had here. And I told you the reason I'm interested in this is because that is your product here.
Mm-hmm.
I want to understand, what is the ideal or the best outcome of your product so that I can put myself in the shoes of you, the owner of that thing, and try to imagine how can I create an experience between both of us that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Right? It's just about turning the tables. And that is exactly the same independently. Either you're talking to a customer,
mm-hmm,
and you're trying to turn the tables, or you're talking to someone who helps you build the product, like someone in support, someone in documentation. In the end, what you care about is creating those complete experiences for the users, which is very, very hard to do unless you can ingest various perspectives and understand where people are coming from.
Mm.
You might disagree with what people tell you, and that's quite all right. However, if you see voices coming up, and you as a product manager should enable those voices to come through because you really want to get those perspectives that you're missing.
Yeah.
Once they're there, it's a gift. Take it, listen in, agree or disagree, but you need to learn to keep them on the table and understand why they're there in the first place.
Yeah, and not shut them down.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because that's... I was wondering why you said that. I thought it was curiosity, mm-hmm. but now I understand you were trying to understand what I'm proud of, kind of in episodes that we've created. And I was really happy you asked me that question. You're the only one so far in 140 plus episodes that has asked me, give me the episodes you're most proud of so I can understand what it is you do. And I can be a better guest. So thank you for that, for sure. One of the things you mentioned kind of stuck with me when it comes to, let's say, fighting for your ideas, fighting for a vision that you believe is right. I feel like I do that. Either it doesn't really matter what role I have. It's also in personal life. I've been called a bit idealistic even sometimes, but I like fighting for what I believe is right. And I'm wondering if you've ever had a situation where you thought, okay, this is the vision, basically, and it turned out there was a better vision and someone actually persuaded you, or you got that outside perspective and it changed you. I'm wondering kind of how it changed you in the vision that you had.
That's an interesting question. You know, I've never really gave it much of a deep thought. I think in the end, the way I learned to approach anything in life, including product development, is through the lens of change. And whatever I'm given an opportunity, or within the scope I identify a domain in the direction of which we go, I do spend definitely a significant amount of time carving a grand enough vision that could give myself, but also people around me, enough scope to thrive. So very much by design, and sometimes this is actually interesting because I have conversations with colleagues which are coming and saying, hey, this is too broad, this is too big of a vision. My perspective on this is always that I really want that big vision because I want more people to find themselves within that vision and propose different ways, unthought of ways, for us to achieve those outcomes. So the mindset I'm usually taking here is to allow people to come up with thoughts and steps towards the vision that are beyond of what I can think of. I've never felt really challenged to change the direction.
Yes,
sometimes I might not be very happy with how things are done, pace, structure, the way we package a product, more of those operational aspects. However, within the grand vision, within what we're giving the users in the end, the more we evolve that vision, the more we understand where we're going, the more proud I am.
Yeah.
And if there is anyone in my larger team who says, you know what, that vision that we're having here is small enough, I'm happy to make it larger. If people are saying that seems to be a great idea, but through research, through customer conversations, it seems that this is not the right time, not the right place for it, I'm very happy always to go back to the drawing table and rethink about it. So I think this is another important aspect of product management. You really shouldn't be dogmatic about things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've probably heard, like, you know, if you abstract it for yourself for a second, think about any small startup, anyone who's building a product from scratch. Till the moment they make it, till the moment they find the market fit, they could pivot many, many, many times. And in essence, this is it, right? You're coming with a perspective on life, a perspective on user needs, a perspective on outcomes that the world expects. However, you always come from a very limited set of data points. The moment you get deeper into this, the moment you enlarge your data points, the moment you meet smarter people or people who have domain expertise, or people that just think differently from you, they might change your mind in terms of where you're going.
Exactly.
And if this is very early in the product or a company, then you absolutely should take it. Mm. I think it's a little bit more complicated once you have an established product, once you have an established business model, especially because business models are very hard to change. This is where massive change of vision, massive pivoting is complicated. Like yeah. You couldn't take CBN and, I don't know, make it overnight a company that does lab-grown meat, for example. That wouldn't make much sense, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's based on the investment, both time-wise, process-wise, and the efforts of people. And the more I think you're invested in this vision, the harder it becomes then to change as well. So the earlier you can get, let's say, a greater set of data points and really test the assumptions, I think it's better then to pivot.
Yeah.
And I love what you said, that the vision is broad enough for people to see themselves in it and to be like, okay, this part I understand, this part I maybe don't understand, but the overall vision is sound. And they can still give feedback, they can still criticize, and that's how it gets sharper. But when it comes to, let's say, the essence of a product vision, is that usually, does that come from you as the product manager, or do you gather the business there and do you have kind of a facilitating workshopping where you create a shared vision? Or how does a product vision, let's say, originate in the first place?
So generally speaking, I think you always try to understand, what are you solving for? Mm. And depending on where you are and the scope you're looking after, how that vision comes together might be very different.
Okay.
If you are part of a very, very large company like Google and you work within a specific product domain there, there is certainly already something in place around that general vision for the product that needs to happen.
Yeah.
If, say, in my case, I work with Google Kubernetes Engine, and we do have a vision that is focused on empowering innovation for our users on top of the products that we're building, I definitely would not go and within my part of the sub-product try to create a vision for us to be the best runners in the world.
Yeah. Right?
So there are certain constraints in which we're set. Within those constraints, the exercise of setting a vision is really to try to realize what is going to change for the end user. And, you know, I actually teach quite a bit, including on my YouTube channel, that whole concept structure of vision, strategy, and values.
Yeah.
And the way I usually explain vision to people is that it has to have one important component, which means that the vision is there because it solves a problem that has not been yet solved, someone's problem that exists. And you use the vision to communicate to everyone else what's going to change when you're done.
Okay.
So a vision shouldn't really be very complicated, very fluffy. You know, people think sometimes of a vision as some sort of a aspirational direction that, you know, people cannot relate to. Mm. But actually, if you'd look at visions of large companies or brands that you love, like Visa or like IKEA, you'll see that when you read their vision statements, you really can identify with them. I think Visa has something along the lines of, be the best way to pay and be paid or something like this.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't recall exactly the formulation, but you'll see that most brands that you love, they have very simple visions and you can identify with them. And the reason why is because that vision is very crisp in terms of what is it that's going to change when you, Patrick, are going to use their products and when they're at the end of their road.
Yeah.
Same is with the rest of the things, right? Like, you know, strategy. Strategy is not a bunch of complex things. Strategy is nothing else than, hey, you want to change something in the world. That's your vision. Say with this podcast, you want to make sure that every voice in the Netherlands is heard. Mm. Maybe that's your vision,
yeah.
Right? I think that's a nice vision to have with the podcast in the Netherlands. Now you have the reality, and the reality is, hey, I have 18 million people here. What does every voice is heard mean? Do I literally want to have 18 million people on my podcast? Maybe you do. Then the strategy is just a set of educated guesses you're making on how to take you from the baseline towards that point of change that you call vision.
Yeah.
Those are steps. And you can say, hey, I'll have a podcast with 1 million people at a time. Is it feasible? Not feasible, but that's your strategy. You're trying to experiment this. You know, it's a path forward. And that's the whole structure. In fact, you know, if you look at vision statements, if you look at the baselines, if you look at the strategy paths, at some point you really start to build the muscle how to use them.
Okay.
And they are literally mostly tools for growth and tools for scaling decision making. That's why I don't put that much emphasis on who made the vision, who wrote the vision, or where it came from. As far as I'm concerned, can as well come from Bard or ChatGPT or whatever you like it.
Okay.
What is essential for me is that for myself, for the people that I work with, the vision is clear enough where everyone understands what is going to change for the end, or what would change for the end user and result, whatever we want to achieve for the planet. And as long as it's there, it gives us a great tool to constantly reassess our baseline and make sure we have a sound strategy that takes us there.
Yeah.
That's about it.
That's about it. I've never had it explained so simply that it doesn't have to be complex. It doesn't have to have any fluff or, let's say, marketing buzzwords. It can be as clear, as crisp as you want it to be, as long as it's that stip on the horizon that we can use to kind of keep moving forward and anchor us towards where we want to go. I think that's really cool. When it comes to kind of also your personal career journey, I saw, and you also mentioned that you came from a lot of different fields, right? You mentioned engineering management, product management. Also, let's say with the people aspect, where you were not yourself involved anymore as a product manager, but you were managing other people, right? Educating them, probably that role of empathy there was still very much prevalent there. But why have you switched back, let's say, to an individual contributor in a product manager again? Because some people say management is upwards and individual contributor is kind of downwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm back to people management and product management.
Then you went back again.
I'm back again on people management. It's a very good question, Patrick. I've been going back and forth between people management of teams of various sizes and the individual contribution for quite a bit of time.
Yeah.
And I find it always very refreshing. Mm. I think that if you spend too much time in doing people management without doing the, or being at the end of the IC sort of chain environment, sometimes you lose grasp about how those organizational complexities feel like to the end user. On the other hand side, if you are an IC, it's very liberating because you're literally almost always just responsible for yourself.
Yeah.
Even as a product manager, you can go and you know, grow other people to your point. You could influence people. But in the end, at the end of the day, your responsibility is only you.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you move and become a people manager, you wake up with that question in mind of either A, my team is set up for success. And that to me is first and foremost where my investments go the moment I take over people. I need to make sure that they can find themselves on the team and they understand why they're there, how they're going to grow out of this, and that someone cares about them, right? So it really changes the perspective. You wake up in the morning not with the perspective of how am I going to fix problem A or B. You're waking up in the morning with a perspective of, am I set up organizationally well for success? Where through the actions I make, I force multiply the outcomes, because there are so many smart brains now coming together in a cohesive way to create those complete experiences that I'm looking for. And I think that I very much enjoy both sides of that, both being in charge of myself alone. Well, on the other hand side, for many, many years, and I think I've done people management for more than a decade now, I've always found joy in structurally coaching people to outcomes. And okay. I never take people management for granted. I try to make sure that everyone who's on my team has a very clear plan, very clear coaching plan, very clear goals, but that I also know what's important for them so that I can give them options and alternatives to achieve their outcomes. And actually, you'll be very surprised and how interesting it is when you do people management in a structured way and you really invest in coaching people. Very often, on one occasion, two occasions, you know, three questions, you, Patrick, you can define for yourself at some point, if I push you hard enough, what is your goal in life? And you might have multiple. They could be professional domain, personal domain. Most people in one, two, or three iterations can get to the bottom of what their goal is in life. Most people, after some deliberation, can figure out what is the reality that surrounds them. Very few people can actually identify all the options of the on the table that they have to change their reality and achieve their goals. And if you have a manager who understands what your goals are, understands how you perceive your reality, they are there to constantly listen in and find the right opportunities to channel to you for you to achieve your goals and change your reality. Of course, that comes also with your personal willingness to invest. Time, money, whatever it happens. So the goals, the reality, the will is always on you.
Yeah.
Options are something that you work with your manager, or that manager connects you to other people to help you unlock. And the moment you unlock those options to people, you see them going on a skyrocket, you know, trajectory instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see the joy in that. And I'm also, I mean, dabbling my foot in kind of a more so leadership position, also formally now within Xebia. And I'm enjoying it, but I'm also struggling there because, as you say, this structured way of coaching can be really helpful, but I don't want to be too dogmatic. So I don't really enforce any structured way that much on, let's say, the people I'm coaching or the people I'm responsible for, or the people I talk to in general. I'm wondering if you're the same. How flexible are you, or how dogmatic are you when it comes to, let's say, coaching people? Because I've also heard people say, I'm not great with goals, so I don't really do goals. And then other people say, well, goals are really important because otherwise you achieve nothing.
I'm always out there with the offer of a structure of a framework. And frankly speaking, at least the one that I figured out that works for me to bring the people along has been very successful and generally quite accepted. I'm completely non-dogmatic with what goals people set for themselves. I'm very dogmatic for people to get to the bottom of their goals. Coming with a goal of changing the world is great, but frankly speaking, you could just make yourself a coffee in the morning and feel like the world has changed.
Yeah.
This is not really something to, you know, clearly set to look for. It's like with the vision, right? You could come up with a vision, say, make the entire world run, or you could come with a vision of empowering every athlete. And both are fine, sort of. But the second one is a little bit more clear on where do you want to go.
Yes, more tangible.
You're Nike, right? And yeah. I think that what I've seen is that even that thing, like with the goals, you have to work with people. Everyone in the end has some goal in the morning, right? Like when they wake up, there are things that make them happy, some things that don't make them happy. Very few people I've seen who say, you know what? I'm completely uninterested in anything in life. I'm not sure if you've met people like this. I don't think that this is the case. Yes, they might not have career-related goals. They might not have business-related goals. They might have personal goals.
Yeah,
that's fine as well, right? they might have educational goals. Mm. You should be completely non-dogmatic about what is it that people want to achieve. On the other hand side, the structure of bringing them to where they want to be, it has to be there, because you need to understand that motion of how do you help people grow. And some people will accept it. Some people will not accept it. I think one interesting aspect that I've seen is that sometimes people know what their goals are, but they're not willing to do anything about it. Mm. And that last aspect, which is the will, is what often gets mistaken for the lack of goals.
Okay.
And with will, you cannot force anyone to have a will. Mm. They have to invest something, time, money, attention, and they might not be there today to do it.
Yeah.
And that is okay. But that is for own personal growth. Now, if you use that structured approach as a people manager, you could also make sure that you understand how to feed that person within the working environment in which they are to maximize their outcomes on one hand side, but also make sure that this team member is in the right place at the right time. Mm. Because you absolutely do not want to be in a situation where someone's goal in life today is to make sure that they have time to learn flying, or they just need more time for themselves in the afternoons because maybe they are in a burnout for very long years. And you're saying, I'll put, this person is very smart, you know, I'll put them to work 14 hours a day.
Yeah.
You just don't want to do that. So understanding in a structured way where people are so that you, through those opportunities, can place them for success where they feel they grow, also you maximize the outcome for the team, is very important. I think that if you're not doing this in a structured way, the outcomes might still be there. It's just you will never be able to assess, are we moving in the right direction or not, right? Yeah. So it's, you shouldn't be dogmatic about what people have top of mind for themselves, but I think you should be somehow structured around how do you approach this.
Yeah, I like that a lot. The goals don't necessarily matter, but the structure and the way to get there, that can have some structure and process in there. One of the things you really, I mean, made me reflect about was kind of the lack of will of some people, where they understand what they're really good at, where they want to move, what they want to be better at. But sometimes then their lack of effort or the lack of will, as you put it, holds them back. And that is something from my perspective. I've had ups and downs. I'm not going to say I'm perfect, but I like moving towards something for myself and also seeing other people's move towards something. It gives me energy. It inspires me also to do more and to do better. But for me to inspire someone that doesn't want to do that, that's something I'm first of all, personally challenged with, because I'm like, how or why or when, and I have to accept that. I also have to realize that's okay, exactly as you put it. But then to move them, would you still put them in opportunities that can maybe inspire them or maybe activate that will when it comes to what they want? Do you give those options then as manager, or do you keep in mind that that might be a great option for those people? Is that how you activate them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I do think that, first of all, life is a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. A structured approach is important because you can and should always revisit that situation.
Yeah.
The fact that someone was not having will to put invest or whatever for millions of reasons that can be on the table yesterday doesn't mean that they are not ready for this today. And in the end, within the environment in which we are, because you might be coaching people in two different environments. Hmm. One is in a very private environment, in which case, depending on the relationship you have with these people, you might or might not want to activate them. And, you know, I do quite a bit of side type of help coaching with people who just come and say, hey, I want to change my career. Mm. I want to do this. And sometimes we spend time with them, and I definitely very quickly assess if those people have will. If they don't have will, well, come to me when you are ready.
Yeah.
Then we have a conversation. Or come to me as often as you want when you feel like, okay, there is a spark somewhere happening. That's one aspect of it. Then there is the formal people management. And formal people management on the job almost requires you to activate people.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because first of all, you need to understand their own goals, but you also want to see how can you work together where their goals are also aligned with the company or the team goals.
Yeah.
And where those options are. Because when you align their own goals with the career goals, you bring them together, you actually are maximizing the effect.
Mm-hmm.
People get what they want to get, but then you also get that additional traction in the team, that team spirit, that growth of that person, that capability to promote them, that you're really looking for as a manager. And you know, it's very interesting. In life, I also figured out that generally speaking, the reason why it's so worth investing in people activation, coaching, growth is because the more motivated, senior, educated, satisfied people you have on your team, the less work you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So in a very selfish way, once you realize this, you understand that you have nothing to win from not growing these people, but a ton to lose.
Yeah.
So you better just invest so that you can go on a holiday anytime for a month, shut down your phone, and still know when you're coming back, things will just be fine.
Yeah. Have the confidence in your team and the lack of worries to do so because you've invested in them. And exactly. They've grown to a point where you can. I love that. When you mentioned you moved back and forth, let's say from this more so managerial role from the coaching perspective, let's say formally, because I know you do it outside as well, to more of the back to the individual contributor. Was that also when you, was that kind of when you realized, okay, I'm out of touch with what my people are facing challenge-wise or, I think mainly challenge-wise, maybe priority-wise or what the business needs are, when you felt out of touch with that? Or also when this kind of irk to have ownership of something, just you and not necessarily the team, kind of irked you?
So often this has been related to changes in career for me.
Okay.
Changes in location. I've been moving quite a bit. I'm on my sixth country right now.
Mm.
And sometimes, and I was never really dogmatic about keeping the management line.
Yeah.
I was always more interested in the job I'll be doing rather than where am I formally in the organizational structure. Mm. So often those changes have been triggered by a change of profile of the work that I was doing. And first of all, I find this extremely exciting that I've been part of various roles in technology because it exposed me to what people do in general.
Mm.
I know what a project manager does because I've been one. I know what a sysadmin does because I've been one. I know what a manager does because I've been one. What a manager of manager does because I've been one. Product manager because I've been one. You very quickly empathize with those people later on. You understand various aspects of the business. Consulting, you know, you've done this, you've been there. And then, of course, when you switch back to the IC, I think that it's easier to understand when organizations become bloated or dysfunctional.
Because
when you're a people manager, there are so many things that are moving, you know, you have to do this reporting, this, this, and this. On one hand side, as a manager, you understand why you want to put the structure, why you want to put all of that. Well, you know, not necessarily complexity, but sometimes it grows into complexity. When you change back to the IC, you actually sense those structures even more acutely because you see them happening all the time. And I think that switching the roles allows you to really understand what is good enough in an organization.
Yeah.
And if you were just moving through the ladders, managing people, sometimes, and maybe that's not with everyone, you get out of touch on what is it that the time of the end person, of the IC, has to really be spent on.
Mm.
If you've been there, you know that if you've been hired as a product manager, you really want to do product management. You don't want to get another 55 things on top of your head to do because the organizational structure has been bloated to the point where you get millions of inputs of what's important. And when you do those switches, that becomes very apparent where that balance, where this finance balance is.
I can see that. Yeah. I wasn't doing it consciously. Again, curiosity has always been a big driver of me. Years ago, I always thought, okay, this product management role, having the responsibilities, figuring out what stakeholders want, what they really need even, also from an end user perspective, that always sounded really interesting to me. So I'm happy that I get opportunities to make those switches and exactly what you said, to then gain a perspective to learn from, to also empathize with the other party if I switch back to a different role in that way, and to gain a better understanding of how everyone is functioning, if I think they function or if I think they do what they need to, or if their plate is just bloated with stuff based on the organization. I think that's very valuable. It's never been the goal for me to learn because of that. Again, it's just curiosity. But I like that that is a great byproduct and that would probably make me a better professional in the end. Yeah. I want to thank you, Roman. This has been a blast of a conversation. I think, really a great listen back to when it comes to how to be a great product lead, product manager, and even manager, coach, and just person. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Patrick. It was a pleasure to be here. And I'm looking forward to keep listening to Beyond Coding.
Thank you so much. I'm going to put all Roman's socials in the description below. Check him out. Let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, thank you for listening. We'll see you on the next one. Beyond.